This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Katie Henriksen.
Christina Thomas.
Timothy Dennis.
Jackie Froehlich.
And this is the last, these are the last few days of 2013, and as has been the custom now since we have become a daily program, we spend the last week of the year talking about some of our favorite stories. And so we all get together and do that. And I am going to tell you that the first story we're hearing is a favorite story of mine from 2012.
Because you're cheating.
Because I am cheating. Here is why I get to pick Gibson Baskets. It's because it was aired on the last day before we did our favorites weeks last year. Mm-hmm. And I love the story so much about Gibson Baskets because it is quite the Northwest Arkansas tradition. But if we would have put it on the favorite shows of 2012,
it would have aired like the next day.
Exactly. Like, here's the piece you heard yesterday. So this was, I traveled to where they make the Gibson Baskets, which is inside the Fayetteville city limits. And it was a cold, overcast December day. And I got to go through the process. Before there were Tyson selling poultry in Northwest Arkansas, before Walton's reimagined retail, before Neil's sold pies in Springdale or George's Majestic Lounge had cold beer on Dixon Street, there were Gibson Baskets. Christopher Columbus Lum Gibson began making baskets more than 120 years ago. He taught his son George. George taught his son Don. And Don's son Terry is making baskets the family way still.
My two cousins that know how to make baskets know how. We all grew up together, and we all the basket shop was in my backyard when I was a child. And my grandpa made baskets there, my uncles, my dad, so you know, we just all grew up in it.
The Gibson Baskets have achieved their own kind of fame here and far beyond. The baskets have been featured more than once in Southern Living, have been displayed at the Smithsonian, and were used by then-Governor Bill Clinton as gifts to his fellow governors during a governor's conference in Little Rock. They're always made by hand in the style Lum was using back in the 19th century. Terry Gibson makes thousands annually at his place west of Fayetteville along Weddington Drive. This week, with a warm fire crackling inside and his roosters crowing outside, he explained how a white oak tree can become a basket.
And you split the tree, keep splitting it down as many times as you can till you get a pretty thin board.
Before the trees can be split, the bark has to be stripped clean. Terry follows the same procedure for this process that the three generations before him used.
Exactly. This is exactly the same method. Growing up as a kid, I remember big piles of this bark all laying all around.
He concedes there has been one change since the 1880s. Terry uses a chainsaw to fell the oak trees he uses. The crosscut saw of old has been retired. But there are plenty of other tools at Terry's disposal that have been used for a very long time. Take, for example, the froe he uses to split logs into smaller logs.
It's an old-timey tool, and this particular one here was plowed up in a field and handed down to me, so this is probably 100 years old.
The froe is a heavy, tapered chunk of metal sitting inside a wooden handle. He places the tool inside the wood and smacks the metal with another piece of wood. After just a couple of firm taps, the log divides into smaller, even pieces.
I always try to split it right down the middle.
Then he splits the smaller log again, then again reducing the wood into smaller slivers that can be taken into the same shop he's been using for more than 24 years.
This is called the split bench. This is what, it's like a wooden vise is what it is. And put your board, this is called a shaving horse. And what I'll do is I'll take this.
This is a long blade with handles on either side that he takes in his hands as he sits on a bench-like contraption.
This original part of this I made when I was 17. This has been replaced because you whittle on it, but this is pretty old.
Terry rakes the long blade across the top of the smaller wood piece he's brought in from outside. Over and over, he shaves the wood into a streamlined strip, the white oak bending slightly each time the blade cruises over the bark.
Now, I know you've been doing this for more than four decades, but I get a little nervous seeing that blade get that close to your stomach.
Well, you just don't think about it.
Okay, sorry I brought it up.
I have cut myself before. mostly on my fingers. I never have cut my stomach, but...
When he was a boy, Terry could earn a nickel for each strip of wood he trimmed for his grandfather. His grandfather, by the way, made baskets until he was 89, so Terry made quite a few nickels.
And I could work for my uncle, my dad, my grandpa, you know.
Right.
And I just picked up the little bits of it here and there, and then all of a sudden, by the time I was 12 years old, I was doing everything.
Next, the wood is tightly secured into a sort of vise called a split bench that Terry's used for more than a quarter century. Holding his knife sideways, he peels the outer band off of the wood. Each of these steps narrows the wood so it can eventually be woven into a basket. The Gibson family tradition has about 50 varieties of baskets, different sizes and shapes. Each has its own name, picked by Terry's great-grandfather. The basket called the large round egg basket was big and was used for carrying round eggs. The two-pie basket could carry two homemade pies. These particular strips are just the right size for a pie basket. Terry takes them back inside the house. There, Terry's wife, Connie, she also makes baskets, holds a block of wood that will serve temporarily as the base of the basket in progress. The strips will be placed on top of the block, and then other strips will be interlaced over and beneath, creating a signature pattern that will make the basket strong enough to carry whatever can be fit inside. Connie says the weaving process is one reason some Gibson baskets have lasted longer than a century.
No nails in our baskets, but all our baskets have nail holes in them, because that's how you hold it together.
For each of the 50 or so types of Gibson basket, there is a separate block to put under the wood to begin the weaving process. Each basket then slowly comes to life as Terry or Connie gently lace the wooden slices in, over, and underneath each other.
You have to split an upright piece like this. That makes your over and under weave work out.
So you're weaving a spiral all the way up. If you don't split that, it's like a Missouri basket. A Missouri basket has one weave around and it stops. And you weave one around and stop. This gives you a continuous weave all the way around.
While the Gibsons create thousands of baskets every year to be sold at farmers' markets in Bentonville and Fayetteville, some are sold at retail places like the Ozark Folk Center in Mountain View, and a very few stay in the Gibson home. The last basket Terry's father ever made is above the fireplace, and hanging nearby are a few other baskets Connie says are too special to let go.
That was our first son's basket, and he slept in that while he was young. This one here was Terry's first one that he made a swivel handle one, and that's where the handle sways back and forth, and that was our picnic basket.
Okay, so that's the last story you'll hear from 2012. Now we'll go to our favorites from 2012. Yes, Christina?
I'd like to throw in just one thing that is a very sound-rich story.
Yes.
And you did that with your iPhone.
Funny story. I pulled up in the driveway of where the baskets are made, and I looked in the back seat where I always keep my equipment, and I had forgotten my mic cord. So I had a microphone, I had a recorder, but nothing to connect them. And I was running very close to the time we said we needed to be there anyway. So I pulled out the iPhone and with an app, and
we're able
worked.
To capture all that sound.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm sure other people have had that experience.
I have.
Just recently, right?
Right.
Yeah.
It happens.
Well, thank goodness for smartphones and for apps that let you record. Jackie, now I'm going to let you talk about a story that did air in 2013. It also near Fayetteville.
One of my favorite hiking destinations, Rock City, a place called Mount Kessler. It's just southwest of town, and a number of people live on it. But it's also this remarkable ecosystem. It has all these karst, really the most unusual karst rocks in the area. The residents and concerned citizens are trying to raise money to preserve the parcel as an ecological, recreational, and educational area. And so I illustrate that last point, the educational area, with a site visit. It was last spring with our favorite dendrochronologist, David Staley, at the University of Arkansas. It's a tree ring. Tree ring scientist, and he's just brilliant. And we go to this ancient grove of chinkapin trees. We're hiking up a muddy path on Mount Kessler this cold winter morning to check on an old growth forest with Dr. David Staley. He's a distinguished professor of geosciences at the University of Arkansas and a dendrochronologist. He travels the world studying the insides of trees, more precisely, tree rings. He stops for a minute to explain.
Tree rings, they provide one of the very few, you know, chronological records of environmental history that can be dated with exact precision. I mean, to the exact year and season in which it formed. And as we change the world, as we change the environment, you know, we're very interested. Ecologists, climatologists, hydrologists, and others are very interested in what was the natural variability of these systems prior to human intervention. I mean, something that we'd like to manage towards.
Dr. Staley's applying his science on Mount Kessler, which contains old-growth forest and other rare features. He and others envision transforming the parcel into a wild outdoor laboratory, similar to Harvard Forest, Duke Forest, Cornell's Arnott Forest, and the University of Wisconsin Arboretum, to name a few.
Here we have that kind of potential right here on Mount Kessler for an outdoor laboratory for our environmental geosciences labs. We go to the field and we teach them about environmental variability, the ecology courses at the University of Arkansas, soils, hydrology courses. I mean, there's a number of faculty that could utilize an outdoor laboratory.
We are accompanied on our hike by one of Dr. Staley's grad students, Alan Edmondson, and Isabella, a Great Pyrenees, who protects our herd of goats down the mountain, along with two of her rowdy buddies, Ginger and Pepper. The path narrows through an immense, dark, towering rock formation, what the locals refer to as Rock City. It leads to a forested bluff vista on which stand a grove of gnarly, ancient, old oak trees.
This chinkapin oak-dominated woodland. And you can see, I mean, there's a super old chinkapin oak right there, and over a century old. And up on the side of the hill there, there's several that are 200, maybe 200 plus. The oldest that we've found in here so far, what was it, Alan?
I think it's 250.
250 years old.
Geosciences grad student Alan Edmondson from Fort Smith will survey, map, slice, drill, and catalog samples from the ancient oak woodlands of Kessler Mountain for his geography master's thesis.
What's proposed now is that I would start mid-May, and I'd do probably about a month of field work, just every day for a month out here, just all day long, every day. Just come out here and core trees and cut cross sections from down logs at dead trees. Do the lab work June, July, and do the write-up, and hopefully be working on the write-up the whole time. But I look to have the whole project done by August 31st of this year.
But they've already started to work. He and Dr. Staley have cored four relict or surviving trees using a special hollow hand drill called a Swedish increment borer to extract long, thin tubes of living wood.
A lot of heart rot, so we'll never be able to say with certainty just exactly how old they are, but we can say they are at least, say, 250 years old. Our thinking is that the oldest are 300.
These chinkapin oak should not be confused with the chinkapin chestnut, which suffered a terrible blight last century.
Yeah, the Ozark chinkapin is Castanea ozarkensis, and it suffered tremendously in the Ozark blight. It's not extinct, but it's been reduced to stump sprouts, to coppice growth, and it's threatened for sure, and unless we're able to find some kind of treatment for the blight. Chinkapin oak is Quercus muhlenbergii, and it's an oak, and it's called chinkapin oak because its leaf resembles the leaf of the chinkapin, the true chestnut chinkapin.
Chinkapin oak acorns are sweet compared to other oaks, says Dr. Staley, so are edible to humans. Plus, the trees are not that rare.
Chinkapin oak is an interesting eastern oak, one of the most widely distributed. It's found all the way from Delaware, from Lake Champlain region of northern New York, Hudson Valley, all the way into northern Mexico, crosses the southern Great Plains into the Trans-Pecos country of the Guadalupe Mountains in Texas, where we've studied it. There we found 450-year-old chinkapin oak.
And if we think the drought of 2012 was extreme, these old oaks have withstood worse conditions.
And they would have to, wouldn't they? If you're going to live on this rocky, west-facing bluff line for a couple hundred years, you're going to have to be able to suffer through the occasional severe drought, the occasional decade-long drought. And so that's one thing the tree rings tell us, is that this region of western Arkansas has suffered decade-long droughts. Of course, we recorded the 1950s drought, the Civil War drought. There was a big drought at the end of the 19th century. Then, of course, the Civil War drought. And there's an epic drought, perhaps the worst one in the last 300 years, in the 1780s, all across the Ozarks.
And it's likely the Chinkapin Oak Research Project will discover some living witnesses to that historic 1780s drought. Still, much of the mountain, like the rest of the Ozarks, has been ravaged by human incursion.
You know, the place has been savagely logged. I mean, let's be real. I mean, Kessler Mountain has been lived on and utilized, you know, since the dawn of Euro-American settlement in the early 19th century. There's been plenty of logging here. But there are these non-commercial parcels of old growth that were not worth logging. Now, for me, they're among the most beautiful because they are found on these exposed rocky outcrops with the great views of the western horizon. And the trees themselves are beautiful and appear like a kind of Japanese garden in many ways.
The Kessler Chinkapin Oak Research Project will be the first of hopefully many conducted on the forest preserve. But just how Mount Kessler came to be in peril traces back to 2004. A group of investors had purchased 900 acres of land, including this part of the mountain, for a mixed-use development called South Pass. The real estate bubble burst, forcing a default on the $22 million property loan carried by family-owned Chambers Bank of Fayetteville. As part of an original good faith agreement, the bank plans to donate 200 acres to the city of Fayetteville for a new park. That leaves 700 acres for sale, including 387 acres of Mount Kessler. Concerned landholders who reside on a patchwork of parcels on Mount Kessler formed a group last year to protect it, led by Frank Sharp, whose family settled Sharp Farm on Kessler's north slope in the early 1940s and operated the famous Ozark Mountain Smokehouse franchise.
Mount Kessler Greenways is a group of neighbors that our motto, as we grow, let's keep some country, because we want to keep, you know, we know there'll be growth, but we want to keep our trails and woods.
Over the years, recreationists and preservationists have carved 8 miles of rugged trails for hikers and cyclists who need special permission to explore Kessler's remarkable rock formations, forests, and mountaintop glades. To prove his intent, Frank Sharp, along with another landholder, placed more than 100 acres of their own private property into conservation easements and have started to pool donations. And now he's soliciting advocates to help prevent the 387-acre Kessler Bank-owned parcel from being developed.
Okay, advocates are people that I have accosted on the trail and gotten their email addresses. And I asked them if they'd like to be an advocate, and most of them are, said they would like to be. And they do things like write letters, raise money, and so that's what the advocates are.
Now down the east-facing slope and adjacent to a planned new city park, the University of Arkansas is considering the purchase of 100 acres of field along the old South Pass property to expand its sports complex. And Kessler advocates, including scientists like Dr. David Staley, see this as an opportunity for the UA to acquire the rugged 387-acre parcel above it to set aside as an eco-preserve and an outdoor natural science laboratory. Once again, project coordinator Frank Sharp.
One possible scenario is it could be sort of like the Walton Arts Center, where it was owned jointly by the university, the city, and they would have a board, sort of like the Walton Arts Center Council, that would be made up of representatives from the university and the city, plus other groups like Fayetteville Natural Heritage and Ozark Off-Road Cyclists and people like that.
Chinkapins, which used to be much more plentiful, right, in northwest Arkansas than they are now, yeah. You talked to Mr. Staley this year as well.
I did, about determining the history of drought by looking at tree rings. I mean, David Staley, he's done this big research project on, hundreds of years ago, I mean, literally hundreds of years ago, by looking at tree rings, you can tell what the conditions were like. I mean, if it was a rainy season or not. So,
well, Christina, as long as I'm talking to you, one of your favorite stories this year allowed you to go into a place you'd always wondered about.
I know. I live out toward Goshen off of Highway 45, and for my whole entire life, I've driven past Sun's Chapel, and it's actually another kind of preservation effort. These women raise, the Rural Builders Association, they quilt and try to raise money to preserve Sun's Chapel. And I went and I got to talk with some of these women and got to step foot inside this church that, even though I'd driven past every day, had never been in.
So here is our chapel, seats about 100. We have had to replace pew covers and rugs, but otherwise it's very much like it was originally.
Originally, when Sun's Chapel was completed in 1939. Trisha Beeland is the historian for a group of women called the Rural Builders, started by four women with the main purpose of building this chapel 91 years ago. History says this land was once owned by the Sun family in the mid to late 1800s. There was a chapel of sorts, a wooden building on the edge of the cemetery across the street, though the date of its demise is unknown. Clearly, before 1922, the date that the women in the community came together to begin raising money for construction of the current chapel.
And they were farm women. They did what they knew how to raise money, which was make quilts and sell them, have little craft get-togethers. They made lunches and sold them at cattle auctions. They put on dramatic performances and charged some amount of money. And 1922, it took them until 1939 to actually finish the building because there was a world war, there was a depression, and their husbands did a lot of the labor. They had to hire a few local craftsmen. But a building doesn't like go up as quickly as they do now.
Nor do the costs compare. With $1,400, after 10 years of fundraising, construction began. A formal plaque nested in among the brown and gray rock on the northeast corner of the chapel commemorates its dedication in 1940.
Sun's Chapel, conceived by the Rural Builders Club, 1922, quoted, "With the Lord's help and our husbands, we can and will do it." Chapel completed 1939, and the cornerstone is in memory of David Robert Henson, 1921, 1991. The Henson family were early residents of the area, and his daughter, Linda Lilly, Henson Lilly, was a longtime member and officer and died within the last few years.
The colorful stained glass with the dove that makes up the top portion of the front window of the chapel was donated by the Henson family. Back inside, if you look out this same window, you'll see a tall and sprawling sycamore tree that is as old as the chapel itself. The church is, and always has been, non-denominational, and never actually held church services, though Sunday school was held each Sunday until 1996.
The community used to come have a Sunday adult Sunday school upstairs, children's Sunday school downstairs, and then be released in time to drive into town to go to the church of their choice. Buddy Crouch, who is just recently deceased, was the last one.
The pulpit, about 30 feet across from that stained glass window, held a buzzer for the adults to alert the children in the basement that they were finished with their studies. The 20 or so pews are showing their years, as is the brown particle board that makes up the walls and ceilings. Beeland says that it's no longer made, and it's expensive to have it repaired or replaced. Two original light fixtures of gold and clouded glass hang over either side of pews, in between ceiling fans that were later installed. Though a gas furnace was put in during original construction, air conditioning was just recently installed. Sun's Chapel has about 10 weddings per year, and brides are not as inclined to stand in the heat in their attire as they once were. Weddings are just one way that the Rural Builders raise money to maintain the church. As the group is still active, fundraising and upkeep are its main goals. And keeping with the tasks of the original members, a second way they earn dollars is with quilt sales. Every Tuesday morning, hence the day of my visit,
A group of 20 or so ladies meet in the basement of the chapel to quilt.
I have a seat right here and go just visit. I'm Jeanette Loris. We quilt to raise money.
This is Liz. And Eloise.
Hi, nice to meet you.
We're the fundraising group for the chapel. And we basically do it, the quilts, we quilt. Most of them are hand embroidered. Some of them are machine embroidered, but very low percentage. We sell the quilts. And this has been an ongoing fundraiser for probably about 20 years. And it also brings in many new members, so.
Though knowing how to quilt is quite helpful, it isn't a requirement for joining Rural Builders. Jeanette learned when she joined, and though Tricia tried to learn, they made her the historian. Embroidering the centerpiece for a baseball-themed quilt is Susie Shelton McCray, a third-generation Rural Builder.
My grandmother was one of the four ladies that started the Rural Builders Club 90 years ago. They decided that we needed a church in the neighborhood. And they raised every penny. Some of the men helped with the work, but the women raised all the money that went into it.
Her grandmother lived right down the hill on Shelton Road. Susie was 8 when her family moved there. She fondly remembers Sunday school and other community events held at the chapel. The site also held a one-room school from 1890 until 1949, when it was moved down the other side of the hill and turned into a residence. Susie attended that school for the 3rd, 4th, 5th, and part of the 6th grade. She was also the first bride to marry in the chapel in 1948. And though she lived elsewhere for 60 years, she returned here every year, even embroidering from her home in Wichita Falls, Texas. She came back for good almost 3 years ago. Emerging from the historian's collection is a black and white photo.
This is my mom. This is my grandmother. And that's Mrs. Robinson, who was one of the four. And that's Mrs. Brazil, who was one of the four. And I have Mother's little sailor hat. I collect hats. So this is our, when we celebrated our anniversary, and I think that was just last year.
Sons Chapel, you went there, it was warm when you went there.
Oh, it was early fall.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. This is a special year-end edition of Ozarks at Large. All this week, we're talking about some of the favorite stories we did in 2013 and the last little bit of 2012. And Timothy Dennis, you've now been with us for more than a year.
Yes, I have, and it's been a blast the entire time.
Oh, well, good. you did a story this year about an effort that was just beginning at the time, Feed Fayetteville.
Yes, back in March, I had heard that Feed Fayetteville, Feed Communities, they were moving into a new location just a couple blocks over from here. And so whenever I went over there, they were actually having a volunteer day. And they were just, you know, using volunteers to spruce up their new building and the surrounding area outside, building garden beds and other stuff like that. But what was amazing about it to me is that the majority of the volunteers they had, you know, Feed Fayetteville and Feed Communities, they're both local-based organizations, but the volunteers they had were all from out of town, and it was just interesting to see them helping this local organization. This was the scene last Thursday when 60 to 70 volunteers from Sam's Club convened at this site on Locust Street near the downtown Fayetteville Square. The former church is a white bricked two-story building that was constructed in 1945, but it will soon be home to a local foods campus of sorts for the local group Feed Fayetteville. Adrian Schoenfeld is the executive director of the local nonprofit.
There was a need in the community for a centralized place where people could come and have education and resources and just community efforts combined, because we were all kind of out in the community doing our own thing, and then we didn't really have a centralized location. So this is the embodiment of every activity that we did last year, so we can all come together in one place.
Feed Fayetteville, along with its parent organization Feed Communities, is part of several food security programs in the area. Programs such as Canning Hunger, where produce from local gardens and the Fayetteville Farmers Market are preserved for winter use at community meals programs in the city. With the new facility, the group will be able to have that canning operation on site. Another program among the many that will benefit from the new space is one called Care Cropping,
which is a gleaning program that we do at the farmers market. And we were doing it out of the back of a car last summer. And so this building will help us be more sustainable and just keep the food fresh longer and be able to give a better variety of food instead of taking one location 400 pounds of squash like we did last summer. So it'll help us be more sustainable in our actions. We also have cooking classes that we now do at different Head Starts and churches and around town, so we'll be able to do all those here. And then we'll also have an on-site snap garden, which is we're really excited about doing a little urban ag project and growing food with snap participants right here on our campus.
Outside, volunteers proceeded to build several beds for the snap gardens. Jack Amerson is one of those volunteers. He tells me how these beds for fresh veggies are being built.
We're moving soil into the mulch gardens so that we can create a layer of topsoil here to grow fruits and vegetables with, and the community can come in and weed and feed and water and pick.
But because these are just the first steps in renovating the site, the gardens aren't being built in a permanent fashion.
And we're using straw bales and doing raised beds because we don't really have the permanent master landscape plan down yet. So this year we're just showing that people can grow with limited resources and just pop up in a parking lot, basically.
Showing how to grow a garden in new spaces is one thing that Feed Fayetteville staff hope to teach the community. Melissa Terry is the program coordinator for parent organization Feed Communities. She says that both organizations were formed out of the fruits of a community stakeholders meeting 2 years ago. Terry says that Denise and Hershey Garner called the meeting in response to high statistics of childhood hunger in Arkansas.
And so Denise and Hershey convened a group of stakeholders at St. Paul's Episcopal Church, just to see if we could figure out some basic starting points of, like, is community hunger solvable? What is going on? Why are the statistics so high that one out of every four kids in Washington County is listed as food insecure? And so we had intended for about 20 people to be at the stakeholders meeting, and then in the end, there were 60.
But to lower the number of area residents who are food insecure, the group had to approach the problem with efficiency in mind. So organizers mapped out all of the separate community meals and food resources that were in the area, mainly to determine where there was overlap of services or where partnerships could be beneficial.
The Food Hub is the physical space that represents the mental work that we did last year of aggregating mentally and by conversations, like all the different food groups that we could think of in community kitchens and whatnot. And then as we progressed, we realized, like Adrian was saying, that we needed a physical space where we could just be a library, a resource, a base camp, a community garden.
Not only are the different programs Feed Fayetteville sponsors designed for efficiency in the community food systems, but the facility is being designed with that conservation in mind. One of the projects that volunteers were working on during the warm March afternoon was the construction of several rain barrels. Volunteer Gary Fisher from Charlotte, North Carolina, says that building one of the 50-gallon plastic rain collectors is simple.
It is pretty easy. All you do is take and cut the top off, drill a hole in the bottom to put the spigot, so when you get the water in, you have an overflow valve on top, and that's pretty much it.
But conservation is only one aspect that drives an organization like Feed Fayetteville. The community aspect is not only where the group focuses its aspirations to help ensure food security, but the community also plays a key role in helping the organization accomplish that mission. For example, the organization didn't purchase its new home. Instead, Feed Fayetteville founders Denise and Hershey Garner purchased the property and gave a 20-year lease to Feed Communities to use the space as offices for the two organizations. But Schonfield says that the community helps the organization in other ways as well.
And like Melissa was talking about the garden tool share, we don't even have garden tools ourselves yet, so we are actually borrowing from Tricycle Farm. So we all work together. And I think that just the, by definition, a nonprofit serves the community and the communities we work together. So we definitely rely on community support for everything that we do, and we appreciate all the support that we get, too.
That was a story about Feed Fayetteville that Timothy Dennis did for Ozarks at Large this year. This is a special edition of Ozarks at Large. All week we're talking about some, not all, we don't have room for all, but some of our favorite stories of 2013. Katie Hendrickson, hello.
Hello.
You talked to a gentleman this year named Amos Kennedy.
Yes, he is a very fascinating person. He's a printmaker who made prints from a letterpress in his studio in Alabama. When I spoke to him, he had just moved to Detroit and had a campaign to raise money to open a printing press in Detroit. But he's a printmaker, poster maker. He has all these posters up at the Fine Arts Center Gallery they had quotes about how yummy coffee is, and then political quotes and civil rights quotes about Rosa Parks. But he all did this through his poster art, which is personally fascinating to me. I have always been fascinated by printmaking and have studied it as well. So I love the fact that through the university, all these amazing artists come through and I get to talk to some of them. There are so many options for printing these days. So what exactly drew Kennedy to letterpress?
Well, I think the thing that first drew me to it was the availability of the classes that I could take. And that, again, it dealt more with letters than images such as a drawing, which you think about lithos or etching or engraving. So, again, it's about this letter form that drew me to letterpress printing, because I've never really drawn in my life. So that was one of the deterrents. To doing, say, lithos or wood engraving. But this, where the letter was already formed, and then you created the words and you created this image on the page for people to read, attracted me. And I think also the fact that I had studied calligraphy, and there was a close correlation between the two.
Kennedy has been described as a social irritant, and many of his posters convey thoughts such as this one from Albert Camus, which states, "The purpose of a writer is to keep civilization from destroying itself." He did a series of prints celebrating Rosa Parks. Kennedy believes in the power of the printed poster.
The thing about being a printmaker is that you disseminate information. And in the age of the internet, where they say, well, why do you need printed matter? Why do you need posters? Because you can have a website, you can tweet, you can do all these other things. I consider those methods of communication passive, in that people go and find them. So if you're interested in letterpress, you go to the web and you look up letterpress and you find it. And so you engage with that website. A poster I consider active. I consider it because you put a poster up and it invades your visual space, whether you want it to or not. So you put a poster up on the street and you pass by and you notice it. You may not stop and read it, but you notice it, so it invades your visual space. And I think this is the power of the poster or the printed word over the digital word. As a social irritant, it is the dissemination of information that I think is the first calling of printing, and this will create all sorts of controversy. As I tell people, there is nothing more dangerous than the printed word. Ideas are why people have wars. Ideas are why people engage in activities that you may not like. And the printed word allows these ideas to be disseminated a lot better, a lot quicker than the spoken word.
That was a conversation you had with Amos Kennedy earlier this year. And this is a special edition of Ozarks at Large, talking about some of our favorite stories from 2013. In a moment, Antoinette Grajeda is going to tell us about a road trip she took to meet one of the more famous Arkansas residents.
Sure.
Yeah. most of our stories have kind of, so far, that we've talked about have been in Fayetteville or around a Fayetteville subject. I did want to mention that one of my favorite nights this year was spent in Bentonville. I was in the kitchen at the Hive, the restaurant at 21C, and it was a hands-on lesson on how to butcher a hog. They brought out the hog, and it's one of these special nights that can happen in Bentonville in culinary, right? Bentonville's got this association with the James Beard Foundation now, and it was interesting what you could learn about butchering a pig.
You know, if I wanted to do a pork chop, you know, and leave the bone on, have like the super dramatic, you know, pork rack, Fred Flintstone style. Like, I couldn't do that. I couldn't do that unless I butchered the animal myself.
The Hive makes its own bacon. In fact, temporary menu items can be created in the restaurant based on what the chef decides to do with a pig like this. He says the pig is cut, then certain items can be added to the menu almost immediately. The kitchen staff takes turns butchering throughout the year, though Chef Matthew says it's not seen as a chore, but as a way to connect with what got many of them into the business in the first place.
You know, this is really what it's all about. I mean, this is real food from, you know, start to finish. And, you know, you can go buy a steak and you can throw it on the grill and it's, you know, enjoy that and it's delicious and all, but, you know, this is really cooking. That is, you know, skipping a few steps.
Some of this meat could be on plates as early as the next morning. The shoulder cuts, for example, could be breakfast sausage. Pork chops can be on the menu the night after the process, after they've been brined for about 12 hours. Other cuts and meats, like the bacon and the ham, will take longer to go from kitchen to customer. Matthew McClure says almost all of the meat will be on the menu. He says that's the only way to make this kind of preparation economically feasible.
The savings is only there if you use everything efficiently. You know, because you're paying for skin, you're paying for fat, you're paying for head, for feet, for everything. So if you think you're just going to sell some pork chops on it and all will be well, you're mistaken. You have to really use everything.
That was behind the scenes at the kitchen, the Hive, which is the restaurant at 21C. Now, not all pigs that are on Ozarks at Large meet that fate, do they, Antoinette?
No. Earlier this summer, this fall maybe, September? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I got to take a field trip to where Tusk lives. Tusk is the mascot at the University of Arkansas. And I'd had this idea since like April. Mike Birbiglia, the comedian, had come to the University of Arkansas campus. And during his set, people were super loud out in the hallway. So he went out and sort of started harassing some of the people out there. One of the things he asked was, do you even know your mascot? What's its name and where does it live? Which was an excellent question because I had no idea where Tusk lived. So I did some digging and found out that he lives in a farm near Dardanelle in Yell County. So I made the trip down there to hang out with his caretakers and hang out with Tusk a little bit. Fayetteville may be the home of the hogs, but the home of the main Razorback, as in the University of Arkansas's life mascot, is a farm near Dardanelle in Yell County. Tusk 4 is an approximately 300-pound Russian boar who lives on Keith Stokes' farm. Keith was raised in Arkansas, and his family has a long history with the state, as his grandfather was born here in 1880. Growing up, his family ran a poultry farm, and Keith always knew he wanted to be a farmer. When he finally got the chance, he became a hog farmer, which is how he came to be the caretaker of the university's mascot. Keith recalls that in the 90s, game attendance was low, and former athletic director Frank Broyles wanted to do something to improve the game time atmosphere. In an effort to do so, Broyles reached out to former player David Basil.
And of course, David, being a former player, said the first thing he wanted was a real, actual Razorback mascot, because when he played, what they'd do is they'd go out to the university farm and pick up a red Duroc, which is the only hog that's red, but it's not a Razorback, and bring it in, and it Duroc has large floppy ears, kind of like a bloodhound, which always gives you the perception of laziness. And David always said he looked like a lazy hog laying there, but I mean, that's just the way they looked. So I was president of the Arkansas Pork Producers Association at the time, so David contacted me and says, I need to find a authentic Razorback hog, could you help me? And he said he had contacted the New York Zoo and the San Diego Zoo, and they couldn't find them. And a real good friend of mine was director of livestock and poultry called Dr. Starkey, And I called him, and he knew a guy in Greenbrier that had two perfect ones. So we actually found them here in our backyards.
Initially, the hogs were housed at the Little Rock Zoo. After 5 or 6 years, Keith says the zoo hired a new director who wanted to go a different direction, and they needed to find a home for the one hog that was still living. At this point, the university wanted to start a breeding program. The hog was moved to a Tyson experimental station in northwest Arkansas, and the breeding program began. Tusk 1 was selected in 1997 and served as the Razorback mascot for 8 years. Tusk 2 took over for his father in 2004. Tusk 4 is the current mascot, and he entered his first full season in 2011 after debuting at the 2011 All-State Sugar Bowl. He follows his uncle, Tusk 3, who is retired, and both of the animals still reside on the Stokes farm. Keith says this is the 8th year he's had the boars on site. After closing his own hog farm, the opportunity arose for the mascots to move to the Stokes farm, where Keith could care for them every day. According to the Encyclopedia of Arkansas, Razorbacks are wild boars who earned their name because of their high, hair-covered backbone and ill-mannered temper. The true wild boar, also called the European or Russian boar, is not native to the United States. Christopher Columbus introduced their domesticated ancestors to America in 1493. Domestic swine arrived in Arkansas with the first settlers. Several escaped and bred with their wild counterparts and became what we now call wild boars. The Razorback name came to the University of Arkansas after then-football coach Hugo Bezdek said his team played like a wild band of Razorback hogs during a victory over LSU in 1909. The nickname became increasingly popular, and the student body voted to change the official university mascot from the Cardinal to the Razorbacks in 1910. To get to Tusk 4's 8,000-square-foot barn, you can ride an ATV across the Stokes land. After driving across the farm and passing through a gate, you'll come upon the mascot's heated and cooled indoor home. Parked outside is the familiar red trailer you often see him in during public appearances. The 20-year-old custom-built trailer is 20 feet by 8 feet, and while it has no official name, Keith refers to it as the Tusk Taxi. Tusk's living area can be heated or cooled depending on the weather, and it also has a camera, so Keith, as well as his wife, son, or daughter, can watch the hog while they're driving down the road. It's equipped with a public address system, which can be used while the Spirit Squad rides atop the trailer during special events. At night, Keith says they can put up a tent over the top of the trailer where he and his family can sleep, so Tusk is never left alone when he's away from the farm.
He knows when he's in that trailer, nothing bad is going to happen to him. Because, you know, and that makes the whole process much easier. He knows when he gets in that trailer, I'm going to get snacks, I'm going to get treats, I'm going to get attention, I'm going to get my belly rubbed. Let me in there. He is ready to go. But, all it takes is one person to mistreat him inside that trailer, and you're going to lose that trust. You're going to lose all that you've built up. So at all times, he's never alone. There's someone of my family with him at all times when he's in that trailer. But you just open the gate and say, come on, and he's in it. He is ready to go. He loves it. I mean, he loves it. He loves the attention. He knows, like I said, he knows all the good things are going to happen to him. He knows nothing bad is going to happen, so he is ready to go.
Tusk 4 and his uncle are kept in separate pens because Keith says males can be aggressive with one another. A typical day for Keith consists of releasing one of the hogs into their 10,000-square-foot outdoor pen before heading to work at Bibler Brothers Lumber Company. In the afternoon, he switches the boars from outdoors to indoors, feeds and cleans, and at night he locks them up. Tusk is typically fed about 5 pounds of food, which consists of corn and swine finisher. Tusk's indoor pen is comprised of concrete walls that are about 4 feet high. He looks like an overgrown puppy, pacing back and forth, looking for attention or perhaps just food. He frequently jumps up on one of the wooden doors in front of each pen and chews on it. This results in replacing the doors annually.
Come here. Come here. Get up here. Get up here.
Says Tusk likes for people to pet him, and when you do run your hand along his hair, it's hard to say what's more surprising, that his thick black hair is so coarse, or that his ears are so soft. His uncle likes to have his belly rubbed and will roll over on his side while Keith obligingly jumps into his pen. Tusk 4 will be 4 years old in February, and Keith says he's about 20 in people years. Keith says you can judge a hog's lifespan based on his size. The bigger he is, the shorter his lifespan. During game week, Tusk will get washed and loaded into the trailer to make the two-hour drive to Fayetteville for Friday night festivities. Following that, Keith and family will return home and rest. On game day, he and his family head north once again, and it is quite the ordeal.
I've always told people, if you've ever wondered what it's like traveling with a rock star, just take a little trip with us. It is an amazing trip. A lot of people, when they first find out, they say, well, why is the mascot at the Fayetteville at the university? And which is a good question. But actually, and that was a concern when we first thought about bringing him down here. You know, wouldn't it be better for him to be up there? But actually, we get more exposure. He gets more exposure, and the university gets more exposure being down here with the travel up. We have what we call gas station pep rallies. We have a sound system on the trailer, so we can, anytime we can pull in, hit a switch, we've got an instant pep rally. We've got the fight song playing. We got people pumped up. So we have people waiting for us at the gas station. Some people like to follow us up on game day. So it's a pretty unique experience.
Tusk can be found at football games played in Fayetteville and Little Rock, as well as any bowl games. He also makes appearances at other sporting events like basketball games, although those are less frequent because they're often scheduled for weeknights, and Keith and his wife both have full-time jobs. Tusk is definitely a fan favorite, and he can even give autographs. Keith was inspired by participants in the Burles Kids program, who often have their shirts signed by cheerleaders and players. Keith decided Tusk should be able to do the same, so they made a stamp of his right hoof. Fans' dedication to the Razorbacks is inspiring to Keith. For example, during a trip to Dallas, Keith says he was getting fuel when he was approached by a couple he could tell was moving based on their packed truck.
Oh, we got to get a picture. My grandpa was a graduate. He graduated class of 1948 or something. And if he knew we saw this and couldn't get a picture to us, we'd go crazy. So I started talking to him. I said, what? He said, well, they were from Baylor. And they had just gotten a job in North Carolina, and they were relocating to North Carolina. And we're going the opposite way. North Carolina's east. We were going west. I said, guys, y'all going the wrong way. North Carolina's that way. He said, oh, no. He said, we met y'all on the interstate an hour ago, and we pulled over, and we've been following you for an hour, hoping that you would pull over. And I said, so you're going 2 hours, because it's an hour to here, and that's going to be an hour to make up that time. He said, you don't understand. He said, my grandpa would kill me if I didn't know, if I seen this and didn't get a picture. And I mean, I just couldn't believe it, that they they went 2 hours out of their way just to do that.
That was from earlier this year, your visit with Tusk and Tusk's
uncle.
Mm-hmm. And one thing you find out in radio is sometimes you think you're going to go get some great sound in a story, mm-hmm. right? Here's this big pig. Uh-huh. He's going to root and he's going to snort, uh-huh. but he wasn't that loud.
Not really. He was, I guess, snorted happily when we came into his barn, but then he was preoccupied with his food. So, you know, his mouth was busy.
Sure. Tomorrow we're going to have some more of our favorite stories from 2013. I also want to mention we're going to end this with a bit of music from Iris DeMent that was on Ozarks at Large earlier this year. She was part of the Live Roots Festival show.
That was awesome.
Wasn't it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. Thanks so much for listening. More favorites tomorrow.
Morning glory. Your day.